Imagine you are standing in a long queue outside a school building on a Tuesday morning. In your hand is a small piece of paper. You walk into a curtain booth, make a mark, fold the paper, and drop it into a box. That moment feels simple, even ordinary. But what happens next? The journey that small piece of paper takes on its way to deciding who runs your country is one of the most complicated, fascinating, and important processes in modern life. Today, we are going to follow that journey together. We are going to learn how votes become power, how individual choices become governments, and why the rules that govern this process matter enormously. By the end of this lesson, you will understand why two countries can both call themselves democracies and yet produce governments that look completely different, even when their citizens vote in very similar ways. Let us begin with a story. In 2019, a national election was held in the United Kingdom. A party called the Conservatives received 43.6% of all votes cast. That means fewer than half of all voters chose them. Yet when the dust settled, the Conservatives controlled 56% of all the seats in Parliament. That is to say, they had a strong majority and could run the government almost entirely on their own terms. Meanwhile, a smaller party called the Liberal Democrats received 11.6% of the national vote. More than 1 in 10 voters chose them, but ended up with only 1.7% of the seats. Think about that for a moment. Millions of people voted for the Liberal Democrats, and nearly all of those votes produced almost nothing in terms of actual power. How is this possible? How can millions of votes be worth so little? The answer lies in something called an electoral system. An electoral system is the complete set of rules that decides how votes are counted and how those votes are then turned into seats in a government. Think of it like the rules of a sport. Two football matches might both be played on a grass pitch with 11 players on each side. But if one uses the rules of American football and the other uses the rules of soccer, the games will look completely different and the scores will mean completely different things. Electoral systems work the same way. Before we examine the different types of systems, we need to understand two foundational ideas, apportionment and districting. These are the building blocks that almost all electoral systems rest upon. Apportionment. Let us take this word apart. To apportion something means to divide it and share it out. In an electoral context, apportionment is the process of deciding how many representatives a particular region gets to send to the national government. The logic is simple and fair. Bigger populations should have more representatives because more people need their voices heard. In the United States, for example, every 10 years the government counts the entire population in a process called a census. After the census, it decides how many of the 435 seats in the House of Representatives each state deserves based on how many people live there. California, with roughly 39 million people, gets many more seats than Wyoming, which has fewer than 600,000 people. Once apportionment has decided how many representatives a region gets, the next step is districting. This means drawing lines on a map to divide the region into smaller areas, called districts or constituencies. Each district then elects one or more representatives. Think of it like slicing a pizza. The total pizza is the country. Apportionment tells you how many slices each family gets. Districting tells you exactly where to make the cuts. Here is where things get politically dangerous. The people who draw those lines, who make those cuts, can, if they are not careful or honest, draw them in ways that give their own political party an unfair advantage. This practice has a name, gerrymandering. The name comes from Elbridge Gerry, a governor of Massachusetts in the early 1800s who approved a district so strangely shaped that a newspaper cartoonist said it looked like a salamander. Gerry's salamander became gerrymander, and the word has stuck for over 200 years. Here is a simple example of how gerrymandering works. Imagine a region with 10 voters, 6 who support party blue and 4 who support party red. The region needs to be divided into two districts of 5 voters each. If you draw the lines fairly, you might get one district with 4 blue voters and 1 red voter. Blue wins that district, and another district with 2 blue and 3 red voters. Red wins that district. Result: blue wins 1 seat, red wins 1 seat. Fairly balanced. But if Party Red controls the drawing process, they might group all 6 blue voters into a single district, while spreading the 4 red voters cleverly to dominate the other district. Result: blue wins 1 seat, but by a massive margin, and red wins 1 seat more narrowly. The overall vote was 60% blue, but the seats are split 50-50. By drawing lines cleverly, Party Red has used the rules of the game to make the votes count differently. This is not an abstract problem. In the United States today, gerrymandering is one of the most hotly debated issues in politics, and researchers have shown it gives significant advantages to whichever party controls state governments after each census. Now let us look at the different families of electoral systems. There are 3 main types, and each one answers the question, how do we turn votes into power? In a completely different way, the first and simplest is called first past the post, often shortened to FPTP. The name comes from horse racing. In a horse race, there is no prize for coming second. You either cross the finish line first, or you get nothing. FPTP works exactly the same way. Every district elects one representative. Whoever gets the most votes in that district wins the seat, even if they did not get more than half the votes. That is it. Simple. Clean. Fast. Imagine 3 candidates running in a district. Alice gets 35% of the votes, Bob gets 33%, and Carlos gets 32%. Alice wins, even though 65% of voters, nearly 2/3, voted against her. She did not need a majority, she just needed more votes than anyone else. This system is used in the United Kingdom, Canada, India, and the United States for its congressional elections. The great strength of FPTP is that it tends to produce clear results and stable governments. Because votes are divided into districts and only one person wins each district, smaller parties rarely accumulate enough victories to matter. This pushes the system naturally towards 2 large competing parties. Britain has had Labour and Conservative governments for most of the past century. The United States has been governed by Republicans and Democrats, almost exclusively, since the 1860s. When one party wins an election, they usually win it decisively and can govern without needing to negotiate with others. Laws can get passed. Decisions get made. This is called governmental stability, but the price of that stability is paid in representation. Remember the story we began with, the UK in 2019. Those millions of Liberal Democrat voters got almost nothing for their votes. In FPTP, if you vote for a losing candidate, your vote is sometimes called a wasted vote because it contributed nothing to the outcome. When you add up all the wasted votes across a country, you often find that the majority of citizens voted for someone other than who won. The winning party governs with enormous power, but often without the support of most voters. This is the central tension of FPTP. It is efficient, but not particularly fair. The second family of systems is called majority systems. These systems fix one obvious flaw in FPTP. They insist that the winner must receive more than half of all the votes cast, what we call an absolute majority. This seems more democratic. After all, if a person is going to represent a district, surely more than half the voters there should have chosen them. The most common way to achieve this is called the two-round system. In the first round, everyone votes. If somebody wins more than 50% straight away, they win. But if nobody reaches that threshold, the 2 candidates with the most votes go through to a second round, a runoff election, held a few weeks later. With only 2 candidates to choose between, one of them must get a majority. France uses this system to elect its president. In 2017, Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen faced each other in the second round. Macron won 66% of the final vote, giving him a clear and undeniable mandate, that is, a strong public endorsement, to govern. there is another clever version of majority voting called ranked choice voting, or instant runoff voting. Instead of asking voters to come back for a second election, this system asks voters to rank all the candidates in order of preference on a single ballot. Put a 1 next to your favorite, a 2 next to your second favorite, and so on. When votes are counted, if no one has a majority of first preference votes, the candidate with the fewest votes is eliminated. But here is the key. Their votes are not thrown away. Instead, they are transferred to whoever those voters put as their second choice. This process continues round by round until someone has a majority. Australia uses this system for its House of Representatives elections. Think about why this matters. In the United States, third-party candidates often play the role of what is called a spoiler. In the year 2000 presidential election, a candidate named Ralph Nader ran for a small party. He received roughly 97,000 votes in the state of Florida. Democrat Al Gore lost Florida to Republican George W. Bush by only 537 votes. Many political scientists argue that in a ranked choice system, most of Nader's voters would have put Gore as their second choice, and Gore would have won Florida, and therefore the presidency. The spoiler effect can change the course of history. Ranked choice voting is designed to eliminate it. Now we come to the third and arguably most mathematically fair family of systems, proportional representation, often called PR. The guiding idea here is elegant in its simplicity. If 30% of voters support Party Green, then Party Green should receive roughly 30% of the seats in Parliament. Your share of votes equals your share of power. Full stop. To make this work, PR systems typically abandon the idea of small single-member districts. Instead, the entire country, or very large regions within it, acts as a single electoral district. Voters do not vote for an individual candidate. They vote for a political party. The party then receives seats in proportion to its votes and fills those seats from a prearranged list of candidates. Most PR systems include what is called an electoral threshold, a minimum percentage of the vote a party must receive before it can win any seats at all. In Germany, for example, a party needs at least 5% of the national vote. This prevents the parliament from being flooded with dozens of tiny, fringe parties, each representing a handful of voters, which would make governing almost impossible. The Netherlands uses a very low threshold, and its parliament regularly has 15 or more distinct parties, which many Dutch voters see as a feature, not a problem. It means the full spectrum of public opinion is represented. The advantage of PR is clear. Almost no votes are wasted. If you voted for a party that got 8% of the vote, your vote helped send representatives to parliament. In FBTP, that same 8% might produce 0 seats, as the Liberal Democrats discovered painfully in the UK in 2019. PR makes every vote count. It also tends to produce parliaments that look more like the societies they represent, with a wider variety of parties and, often, more women and minority representatives because parties can carefully construct their candidate lists. The disadvantage is also clear. When you have many parties, it is rare for any single party to win more than 50% of the seats. This means that after an election, two or more parties must negotiate with each other and form what is called a coalition government, a joint government made up of multiple parties who agree to work together. Coalition negotiations can take weeks or even months. In 2021, Germany took nearly 3 months after its election to form a government. In 2019, Spain held 2 elections in the same year because parties could not agree on a coalition after the first one. Critics of PR argue that this instability and gridlock is too high a price to pay for proportionality. This brings us to the fourth system, which tries to get the best of both worlds, the mixed-member system. Voters in this system cast 2 votes. The first vote is for a local candidate in their own district, just like in FBTP. The second vote is for a political party nationally. The seats won by local candidates are filled first. Then, the party list seats are distributed to parties to top up their representation and ensure the final result reflects the national vote totals. Germany and New Zealand both use this system. In Germany, the process works like this. There are 299 geographic districts, each electing one local representative by FBTP, but each voter also casts a second vote for a party. The second vote is, in practice, the more powerful one. It determines what percentage of the total parliament each party controls. If party A wins 25% of the second votes, it should hold roughly 25% of parliamentary seats. The seats won directly in districts count towards this total, and any remaining seats the party is owed are filled from a national party list. The result is a system that maintains a connection between voters and their local representative. You know who your local member of parliament is and can hold them personally accountable, while also ensuring that the overall distribution of power reflects what voters actually wanted nationally. It is not perfect, but many electoral scholars consider it the most sophisticated and balanced system in use anywhere in the world today. Let us now turn to the most complex and uniquely fascinating electoral system in any major democracy, the United States Electoral College. To understand it, we need a short history lesson. When the United States wrote its Constitution in 1787, the founders faced a genuine dilemma. They wanted the president to represent the whole nation, but they were nervous about two things. First, they worried that ordinary voters in a large, mostly rural country, many of whom had no newspapers or education, could not be trusted to vote wisely for a national leader directly. Second, they did not want Congress, the group of lawmakers, to simply appoint the president, because then the president would owe his job to them and could not act independently. Their compromise was the Electoral College. Here is how it works. Each state is given a number of electors, representatives in the Electoral College, equal to its total number of seats in Congress. Because every state has two senators plus at least one congressman, every state has at least three electors. California, with its enormous population, has 54. Wyoming has 3. There are 538 electors in total. To become president, a candidate must win at least 270, a majority. When citizens vote for president, they are technically not voting directly for the candidate. They are voting for a slate of electors in their state who have pledged to vote for that candidate. And in 48 out of 50 states, the rule is winner-take-all. If a candidate wins a state by even a single vote, they receive all of that state's electoral votes. This winner-take-all rule has profound consequences. It means that a vote cast for the losing candidate in any state contributes nothing to that candidate's national total. It also means that candidates focus almost all their time and money on swing states, states where the result is genuinely uncertain. Because winning a large but reliably loyal state like California or Texas by a huge margin gives you no more electoral votes than winning it by one vote. If you are campaigning for president, spending a week in Ohio, a state that might go either way, is far more valuable than spending a week in New York, which will almost certainly vote for your party regardless. The most striking consequence of this system is that a candidate can win the presidency without winning the most votes nationally. This has happened 5 times in American history. In 2000, George W. Bush received roughly 540,000 fewer votes than Al Gore nationwide, but won the Electoral College 271-266. In 2016, Hillary Clinton received almost 2.9 million more votes than Donald Trump, but Trump won the Electoral College 306-232. In both cases, the winner of the national popular vote, the candidate more Americans chose, did not become president. This is possible because of how the electoral votes are distributed state by state. People who defend the Electoral College argue that it forces candidates to pay attention to a wider variety of states and protects smaller, less populated states from being completely ignored in favor of the enormous population centers of New York, California, and Texas. People who criticize it argue that it distorts democratic will, that a vote cast in Wyoming is mathematically worth more than a vote cast in California, and that the presidency is the only position in American government that can be won by the person who received fewer votes. This debate has been ongoing for decades and shows no sign of resolution. Let us zoom out now and think about the bigger picture. about what all these systems tell us about democracy itself. Political scientists, scholars who study government and power, generally agree that there is no perfect electoral system. Every system is a set of trade-offs. FBDP trades fairness for stability. PUR trades stability for fairness. Mixed systems try to capture both but can end up being difficult for ordinary voters to understand. Each system also shapes the behavior of politicians. In FBTP systems, politicians must win their individual districts, so they often focus intensely on local issues and local concerns, even when they are national lawmakers. In PR systems, politicians are chosen from party lists, so they may focus more on serving their party than serving a specific local community. There is a debate among scholars that goes even deeper than the mechanics of voting. Some researchers argue that electoral systems shape political culture, the shared values and habits of a democracy, as much as political culture shapes electoral systems. Countries with long traditions of compromise and coalition building, like the Netherlands or the Scandinavian nations, tend to thrive with PR. Countries with strong traditions of adversarial, winner-take-all political competition, like the UK and the US, have built their cultures around FBTP. It is not entirely clear which came first. Did the system create the culture, or did the culture choose the system? Another question that scholars debate intensely is whether any of these systems truly represents everyone. Most electoral systems are designed to represent voters by geography, where they live, and by party preference. But what about representation of gender, race, economic class? A parliament might perfectly reflect how many people voted Labour versus Conservative, but if every single member of that parliament is a wealthy white man, does it truly represent the nation? Some countries have responded to this concern by implementing gender quotas, rules that require parties to put a certain number of women on their candidate lists. Rwanda, perhaps surprisingly, has one of the highest percentages of women in its parliament in the world, partly because of such rules built into its PR system. Others argue that quotas are themselves a form of distortion and that true representation should emerge from free voting alone. This debate is alive and unresolved. What we can say with certainty is this: the rules of an electoral system are never neutral. They are not simply a technical procedure, like the rules for filling out a tax form. They are choices, political choices, about what kind of democracy a society wants to be. A country that chooses FBTP is making a statement that stable, decisive government matters more than perfect fairness. A country that chooses PR is making a statement that every vote and every viewpoint deserves a seat at the table. A country that uses the Electoral College is saying that geography and state identity matter in deciding the presidency. These are profound value judgments wrapped inside what might look, on the surface, like dry mathematical procedures. Remember that cue we imagined at the beginning of this lesson: the school building, the curtain booth, the folded piece of paper. That moment is real and important, but it is equally important to understand the system that receives your paper and decides what to do with it. Two identical ballots, cast in two different countries, can produce radically different outcomes simply because the rules of the game are different. When you understand this, you become a more powerful citizen. You can ask the right questions, not just who won, but how did they win? Was this result truly representative? Did the rules serve the people, or did they serve the parties? Democracy, at its best, is not just about holding elections. It is about holding elections that translate the genuine will of the people into legitimate power. The gap between those two things, between holding elections and doing it fairly, is exactly where the most important political debates of our time are being fought. To summarize what we have covered today, we began by understanding that an electoral system is the machinery that turns votes into power, and that this machinery is never neutral. We learned about apportionment, the process of dividing up seats based on population, and districting, the drawing of electoral boundaries that can be manipulated through gerrymandering. We explored four main types of electoral systems. First, past the post rewards whoever gets the most votes in a district tends to produce stable two-party governments, but can leave millions of voters unrepresented. Majority systems require the winner to have over half the votes, using either runoff elections or ranked choice voting, which eliminates the spoiler effect. Proportional representation aims to make every vote count by allocating seats in direct proportion to party vote shares, often producing coalition governments. Mixed member systems attempt to combine local accountability with national proportionality, as seen most successfully in Germany. We examined the unique American Electoral College, an indirect system that can produce a president who did not win the national popular vote. And we considered the ongoing scholarly debates about stability versus fairness, the problems of gerrymandering, and the deeper question of whether any system can truly represent the full diversity of a modern society. The central lesson underlying all of this is that the rules of voting are choices about the kind of democracy we want, and those choices have real consequences for real people every single day.